Clive Wilkinson, Reel 2. What happened when you returned to the United Kingdom? What was the...
Well, I think I was going to say I had my first ditching in a Harvard in America, in the Everglades. The engine went wrong. And when I came back to the UK, went to a place called St. Mirren, where it was a conversion course, converting from American aircraft to British aircraft. And it wasn't long before I had an engine failure there, and landed in a tiny little paddock on Brown Willy, the mountain in Cornwall, which locals still remember to this day, some of them.
Can you tell me a little more detail what happened while you... What were you flying and what...
I was just flying a Fulmer. Talking about the Fulmer, and you couldn't fly it upside down, but you hadn't got those new carburetors. But you could, but not for very long. So I suppose I induced engine failure, although I swore I hadn't. And a lady came out, and some cottage invited me to tea, and the Home Guard turned up. And one of them was smoking, so I said, put it out and all that sort of crap. I went off, had tea with the old ladies and got back. And when my CO arrived with a recovery aircraft, they'd used the rondels for target practice. So,
when you had the engine failure,
yeah,
what's the kind of procedure for doing a forced landing? What do you look for, and how do you get the aircraft to land? What's the...
Well, what they call a dead stick landing. You've got to maintain flying speed, of course. And in Syria, you should not lower your wheels. Which I didn't do on that particular landing. I lowered my wheels. And of course, you damage the undercar as well as everything else. But we did this intense training on small fields in America, landing with a dead stick in circles. So we were all pretty clued up on that game. Never worried about it. It was just a question of finding somewhere to park down.
What was the Fulmer like as an aircraft to fly?
Well, it was nice, but it was outdated. It was supposed to carry an air gunner. It was a two-seater. Nothing special about it. The Merlin engine. It could cope with Italian flying boats and things like that, but certainly not with Messerschmitt.
So its performance wasn't high-powered, really?
Oh, no. No, but the Navy didn't get any high-powered aircraft, British-produced high-powered. Never. Our decent stuff was American.
What were you doing at St. Mirren? Was it the fighter school or was it?
No, that was a conversion course. That was fun. A lot of beer. Wrens, and you'd fly over the fields and you'd see where the Erks had spent the evening in the hayfield. Good to be back. And then we went to Yeovilton for night flying, which I didn't enjoy. I always hated night flying.
What's the procedure for night flying? Because I imagine it would have been quite difficult in the blackout at that time to do night flying. You wouldn't have any point of reference, would you?
No. The airfield had a few glimmering lights on the runway. You just went off and tooled about and landed.
What did you find most or problematic, or what did you dislike most about night? Was it the fact that you couldn't see anything, or was it just...
I just didn't feel comfortable. If I could have switched off all my instrument lights, I think it would have been better. But you had this confusion of the lights on the instrument board, and probably exhaust flames. I was never at home on night flying. I hated it. I didn't hate it, but I did it. But I didn't enjoy it.
What would you do, just a circuit around the airfield?
Yeah, well, you might go off for half an hour in one direction, come back on instruments, and that sort of thing. But basically, it was circuiting around the airfield.
Is it easy to judge when you're landing at night, obviously where the runway is?
Well, we were batted in, we had batsmen, you know, these jets, and we relied on them to a certain extent. But I didn't find it easy to judge. We came in a bit too fast. It didn't matter, you had the runway to yourself. Yeah.
Was it easy to judge when to do your landing, in a sense of what height you would be at? Because I imagine you kept...
Well, you had this batsman who's supposed to tell you whether you're too high or too low. No, I don't think it was particularly easy. There were numbers of people killed doing it at Yeovil during the war.
Prior to flying at night, had you done any sort of training? I'm thinking of maybe a cover over the aircraft.
Oh yeah, we've done that, all that pain. Yeah. Which was quite sophisticated in America.
How would they do that?
We just sat in this cockpit, which was supposed to assimilate all the movements. You had a joystick and everything, huh? Fooled about that, and then he went up at night with an instructor and again flew off your instruments, and then when that was over, you did it on your own. And of course you had to do a lot of instrument flying through cloud and so forth anyway.
Is it an easy thing to trust your instruments at first?
No, you get this sort of, I don't know quite how to describe it. When you get a senile memory, you can't put a name to it. If you're in the left-hand turn for some time and you straighten out, you get the impression you're in a steep right-hand turn. So you have to trust your instruments, otherwise you are in trouble.
But your senses are telling you the opposite.
Yeah, they are. Mm. But anyway, when you're fully wide in turns and things, you know.
Was the idea then that at that stage that you would be potentially operational in the daytime and at night, or was it that you may have to just be returning to the carrier or something?
Well, returning to the carrier in those days. I don't think any fighters ever took off at night. In fact, the first time it happened was in Shippo's in the Pursuer. I think that was the first occasion, and a few of your own fighters knocked a few enemy bombers out there.
What was the next stage after you'd done your night flying at Yeovilton? Was there any, at that stage, was there any sort of air gunnery practice as well?
I can't remember. The next stage, I was posted to a squadron, 896, whose commanding officer was Stan Orr, a wonderful man. And that was at Quonset Point. We worked up there. It'd be Rhode Islander. Yeah.
What aircraft were you working up on?
Bartlett's.
Is there a difference between British and American built naval fighters?
Oh, very much so. The Seafire, or really the Spitfire to start with, had an inline engine, a Merlin, with a coolant system. And if that, you got a splinter in there, that was the end of that engine. And also, it was impossible to ditch Kotzblue because you had a radiator scoop and it was a low wing monoplane. And it was better to bail out of a Seafair. It was also impossible to land. I mean, we lost at Salerno, I think, 90 out of 120 planes for deck accidents. Which Baldwin always swore that it was due to the flat calm, so they couldn't judge heights. But it wasn't, it bounced like a tennis ball. You've seen pictures of it, see it. Whereas American aircraft, you come in, on this height, and cut the throttle, and the thing just dropped like a brick, bang. There it stayed, mostly. And they had radial engines, Pratt and Whitney and the Wasp, and the Wright Cyclone. And I've brought an aircraft back to the Wright Cyclone with three of its cylinders damaged by ACAC. Lose oil, but they're still churning around. And we had a mid-wing monoplane. You could practically, when you got used to it, you could ditch that thing and get into your dinghy without getting your feet wet, practically. It was a wonderful thing, because it floated and it...
So were they much more rugged then than the British?
Oh, yes. Oh, tremendously. Not as fast, perhaps, as the Seafair. And we couldn't catch up with the 88s and things like that, the early American aircraft. But they were much more rugged. Very tough.
I've heard it said in many respects they built around the pilot American aircraft as opposed to the pilot being squeezed in as the last resort almost with British aircraft. Is that the case with sort of like cockpits?
I don't know. I don't know anything about that. But I do know the Spitfire was a joy to fly. So I was in the carrier trials unit at the end of the war and we did a lot of flying. And a Rolls Royce of an aircraft, you know. But for gutsy stuff, denying to touch the Americans.
So the Marlott, what was the Marlott armed with, was it?
Two or three had four 50 calibers. The next one I've had six. I mean, you can open up the side of a destroyer. Because you centred your own guns on the range. You could have your own pattern. You could have two other guns converging at 250 yards, two at 300, and so forth. But it's a wonderful aircraft.
What was it? You mentioned it wasn't as fast as obviously as the Spitfire, but was it very manoeuvrable, the Marlott?
Comparatively so, yes. But the Marlott 6 at the end was a beautiful aircraft, comparable to the Hellcat. And then the other thing was, of course, the Spitfire had no range. As soon as you got the bugger up, to bring it down again, whereas we could go for 4 hours. An American aircraft, the long-range tank.
What were you doing in this workup period?
Well, squadron, formations, air firing. And Stanor was absolute bugger. He used to, because we flew in threes then. We had sections for threes. They later adopted four. And he used to get us tucked in tight formation and fly under the bloody bridges. He's terrible.
When you're flying in formation,
yeah,
how do you formate on each other? What, is it literally just pointing the aircraft towards the lead aircraft to get underneath, or is there much more of a technique to it?
Like you're formating on a lorry on a motorway. You improve each time you do it, but you can get really tucked in. Yeah. Very close. You have to try and avoid the other aircraft slipstream, so you'd probably be a bit lower, a couple of feet lower than wing level.
Do did you know at this time what your role would be as fighters, what it was likely to be as a squadron?
No, I assumed I would join a carrier and that would be that. Which we did when we worked up, we joined the Victorias.
We haven't touched on obviously training for landing on carriers and the techniques that you use.
Yeah.
Could you give me an idea of how you went about training to land on carriers and how you eventually landed on carriers?
Yes, they had things called ADLs, assimilated deck landings or something. And a chap, the signalman, so the batsman, stood there and you landed again beside him until you've got the art of doing that. And then you tried aboard ship.
How easy is it to do that with a ship at sea or on the water? Is it a large, you know, what does it look like when you first see the carrier? Because I imagine it's quite small in the...
Yes. Well, I never had any confidence at all throughout the war until I joined the carrier trials unit, where we did so much of it. Very few people did.
When you were coming into land on the carrier, what's the system that's in place to slow the aircraft down as you come in?
I have these arrestor wires on the deck, which stand up about that high. They're lifted up by hydraulic jet, and you catch one of them with your hook, which you extend out of your arse, so to speak, and hope you do.
And what happens if you would miss the arrestor wires?
The final thing was that we used to call the Christ Almighty. It's a thing called a barrier, which is an enormous great mesh of steel that would stop anything. Provided you didn't somersault it. That was a terrible thing, because then you landed up on your back. We're talking about deck landings, initial deck landings. Can't really see. USS Charger, 26th of January, crashed, hit barrier. My second deck landing was on February the 1st, HMS Attacker. Got last wire, hit barrier. And my third deck landing, emergency landing, oil temperature, and oil of fire. That was in Victoria. So it was my first three deck landing.
So how did you feel after these first three deck landings? I mean, you said you weren't very confident at that stage. Was it a difficult thing to judge?
Well, it was when you've never done it before. It was hit and miss. The one I didn't like was on the attacker. No, on the charger, because I somersaulted over. And when you're upside down with all those hissing noises going on, it's quite unpleasant to wait.
So you'd come into land and you'd somersaulted over the barrier?
I'd hit the barrier and turned over, landed on my back. And I didn't care for much then.
Were you still with the Martlets at that time?
Yeah, all Martlets, yeah.
Was it quite a rugged aircraft? Did it survive that quite well, all the somersaulting? You weren't...
Well, yeah. Because the prop would have gone and the various other bits in the front. Tail fin would have been smashed. Probably the hood damaged. It didn't throw him over the side.
How did they get you out?
They lift you up with them. But in this case, I think it was the men rather than the crane. They would get hold of one wing and heave it up, and then you'd drop out of the cockpit.
Were you physically injured in the crash, or had you been?
Well, just a few scratches, the usual sort of. You always got hit the gun sight the number of times you had to have stitches in your eyebrows. Anyway, there we are.
How did you feel after doing that? Did you have to get back up there and fly again and try again?
I did. Actually, it was within a period of 5 days. I said, it's not bad going. I said, 3 crashes in 5 days.
So what was the next stage? Obviously, you'd started doing these deck landings on board carriers. Where did you go to from there?
We went out, the Victorious was lent to the American Pacific Fleet, a.k.a. USS Robin, which is something which I think our generosity has never been acknowledged on that. And then we worked with the American Fleet.
Where did you go to? With them?
We pulled in at Hawaii. That was quite funny because it was a nigger ack battery and they mistook our roundels for the rising sun. Because we came in. And Hawaii was great fun in those days. Only 2 hotels on Waikiki Beach. So, and then, from then on, it was pretty bloody miserable. It was so hot down in the South Pacific, in the Coral Sea. I mean, at times, your tires would burst in the air. You'd think, Christ, who's shooting at me? And we were ashore for some time at a place, I think, at Tontuta, in tents, when it rained, and it was inflated.
What type of operations were you flying at that stage?
Oh, fleet cover. Because we had HF radios, and the Americans had VHF. Does it mean anything to you? It doesn't mean much to me. But VHF was in those days, I don't say undetectable, but directional was difficult. Whereas HF was like, you know, Radio Luxembourg, the world could so the Americans had all the fun, really.
Did you have any encounters with Japanese aircraft at that stage?
I never did, no. But they must have done, because we took part in the invasion of New Georgia, I think. We were really blocked because the Americans said we're out of carriers. There were all these things being repaired after the Coral Sea truck and all that jazz. And we and the Saratoga were the only thing stood between the Japanese fleet and Australia. So it was very much a game of bluff. We swapped squadrons, went different ways, and so on and so forth, all to successfully, as it happened, bluff the Japs into thinking there were at least 4 carriers there. But I had, I fell in the sea there, at least my engine pre-detonated on takeoff, and I was picked up and transferred to Saratoga, where I had a lovely 2 or 3 weeks with Admiral Ramsey, American Admiral, so courteous. He used to get me up the bridge every day, you know. And I'd say, why don't we go and have a go at these fuckers? And he'd say, well, I'd like to, but we can't, we haven't got the power. And so,
what had happened on that occasion with the aircraft?
I think it was called pre-detonation. The engine failed on takeoff, and I just plunged into the sea.
Was that in front of the carrier? So what happened as you went over the front? Did you go to one side? Or?
No, I went straight down. The ship hit the bows, hit the plane. I remember being very puzzled because I was upside down, and I was quite keen on. We didn't have scubas in those days, but diving, and I couldn't understand why the water pressure wasn't pressure on my ears. And I remember that was the thing that struck me. I said, no idea what was going on, but I thought, of course, I was down the bottom of the briny somewhere, and I couldn't work out about the water pressure.
How did you get out of the cockpit?
Well, there again, I was bloody lucky, because my parachute, obviously pulled myself by my parachute, straps on the legs, didn't come undone.
Accession number 28936, reel 2.
So how I got out attached to a parachute, I don't know. But there was no shortage of relief, because I had my parachute dinghy, and there was an immersion switch on the bottom of the martlet, which released the dinghy when it touched water. Sometimes if a wave came over the top of the deck, and the marine sentry who stands guard on the quarterdeck, an alarm bell goes, and he chucks a dinghy. So I had three dinghies to choose from. Yeah. And eventually I picked up where an American destroyer, the Case. Very bored. Used up all my cigarettes, which were packed in French letters. And I was used trying to catch something. Was a keen angler, and no fish about. And the Case was interesting because they'd taken all the gun sights off, and they, you know, in an Oerlikon gun, you've got these things you put your shoulders in. They'd taken those off, and the chief gunner's mate had welded bicycle handlebars on all the guns, and they just pumped up tracer. And of course, that burned out the muzzles, so they threw them over the side and put new ones in. We couldn't use tracer. For that reason, we couldn't afford the muzzles.
And this period on the Saratoga, did the Americans operate in a different way to the Royal Navy?
When we joined the American fleet, Captain McIntosh closed the bar. He didn't dare cut the rum ration off, but he closed the bar, so that was miserable. It was so bloody hot. Any relief was hosing seahoo on the deck at night. So. But when I was in the Saratoga, I was shared a cabin, a delightful chap called Frenchy, and supposedly a dry navy, and he had a cupboard full of booze. And we used to sit there playing poker, and these black stewards would bring us Coca-Cola and ice. So, very strange. Yes, they did have things, because she was a big carrier. But there was fun there, too. They had the SBDs, their dive bombers, Douglas dive bombers. And before they took off, first of all, those who were Catholics would kneel down and be blessed by a priest. And then all the squadron would shout something, some song, which finished up, hoity-toity, Christ almighty, we fly the SBD. And they all shook hands and got in their planes and packed it off. And there were some real highlights, because they had bunks, as we always had hammocks, and they had an infestation of crabs. And one of the funniest I've ever seen in my life, the whole ship's company lined up in watches. And the medic's going around with, you know, those flit guns they used to have, giving him a squirt in the bollocks and then one up the bottom. With paraffin, I think it was. They took it very seriously.